Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest at the big table tonight is one of my favorite sports writers in Chicago. Sam Smith is the award-winning writer who used to write for the Trib, now writes for Bulls.com. He's also the author of several books, including one of Chicago's greatest, The Jordan Rules. So great. Smith's new book is another gem. It's called Hard Labor, The Battle That Birthed the Billion-Dollar NBA. In it, Smith explores the early days of the NBA and the ABA, and the players who put their careers on the line to fight for financial equality. Guys like Oscar Robertson, who along with other players took on the NBA and won. But he paid the price. Robertson, as well as guys like Rick Barry, Bob Cousy, Elgin Baylor, Chet Walker, just to name a few, ultimately paved the way for players like LeBron James, Steph Curry, and even mid-level stars like Robin Lopez to make the millions they make today. Sam Smith in studio with me tonight at the big table. Sam, appreciate you being here. Thanks.
No, thank you, Justin.
It's great.
Great to be here.
This
great
book,
to be back in the Tribune building.
they haven't let me back in
for about a decade, so I got patted down as I walked in.
This book is an investigative piece, but it's also a history lesson, and it's also, if anything, a letter to say, hey, we have to treat the players of the NBA history better. What made you write this? What made you go back into the stories of some of these great players from the 60s?
Yeah, a couple of elements, but two things. It essentially is a history and a history of, I'll offer my money back guarantee. If you know the NBA and you can't find 100 things you didn't know before, I'll give you your money back.
So true.
So you can find me at the United Center most game nights. But really, that was the fun of it, that there's so much about Wilt and Russell, Auerbach, and this great era, Rick Barry, and you know, the reason he didn't smile because his teeth were crooked all the time. I mean, stuff you just didn't know. Anyway, but what the inspiration for it, and I don't want to go back, even though I was there at the tail end of the writing of the Federalist Papers. But, it was something that, not because of what the situation with Thomas Jefferson, but just to make the long story short, when he, at the end of his life, he was essentially bankrupt because he lived so well.
Lavishly, right.
And, in effect, people around the country, he tried to have a lottery, and people around the country just simply started sending him money, shopkeepers and farmers, and because for everything he meant to the country and what he did. And that's sort of a message to me with the NBA players. You hear so much, and I wouldn't have done this like 5 or 6 years ago. The money coming in with the new TV deals has been so extraordinary that the average salary is essentially $8 million. Average salary. It's extraordinary. You know, John Havlicek, and I'll get into it because sort of like my writing, I drift all over the place.
No, I gotcha.
But Havlicek told me this story during the Celtics run. It was in the book too, and he was one of the plaintiffs of this suit. We'll get to, but he was making $20,000 a year, and so he went into Auerbach and asked for a raise for $25,000. Auerbach said, "You got to be completely nuts. Your career's over. You can't play. If you think you're going to make $25,000, you might as well retire and go somewhere else." And so John Havlicek, who was an all-star, leading scorer on the team, main
one of
player.
The biggest names in the NBA history,
player,
right?
Got a $1,000 raise to $21,000. And so that era of players, even though there's been pensions, although a lot of guys had to opt out of the pensions, they don't get all the pension increases that have come, a lot of these guys are hurting. And when you become... To become a pro athlete in a United States, anything, football or baseball or golf, whatever, part of it is this extreme level of pride. And these guys just don't ask for help. But you hear players so much these days say, and I hear it all the time, we're a family. Mostly it's a lot of times to fans or media say, you don't understand this.
Yeah, we're a family. You're
well,
not
you know,
a part
you know
of
what?
It, right.
If you're a family, help out your family. And that was sort of the inspiration for writing the book. Because the Oscar Robertson suit, people have heard Oscar Robertson, and some people in basketball have heard of the Oscar Robertson suit, but don't realize what these guys did. It was Oscar who was head of the Players Association, which in itself was extraordinary. In the mid-60s, a black man to be leading an American labor association, negotiating, obviously, with all right corporate America. And so, the background of it essentially is the NFL with the AFL. So the NFL pulls a backdoor trick with the Louisiana Senator Huey Long, who Louisiana politics, no offense to Chicago, is probably more corrupt even than Chicago has ever been, or New Jersey. And so the AFL comes along in mid-60s, whenever it was. In fact, I remember as in New York at the time going to New York Titans games at the Polo Grounds.
Right.
So I know the history myself, and it was pretty brutal. But the players now, for the first time, have some leverage because they can play off the ABA. You know, if I'm going to not—
They could play in the NFL or play in the AFL, right.
Right. So the NFL realizes that this is going to hurt negotiations because I can't do what Red Auerbach did with John Havlicek and just tell him take it or leave it. And the essence of that was the baseball reserve clause, which, right, again, another anti-constitutional measure which protected baseball in the early 1900s.
Because up to this point, with the NFL, with basketball, with baseball even, I mean, there was the suit in baseball as well. If you were drafted by a team, your rights, they could trade you, but there was no free agency. You couldn't say, my contract's up. It was perpetuity.
Absolutely right, and it's a word. Your rights were owned by that team. You were essentially owned. I mean, Kurt Flood famously said, no matter what you make, if you're owned by someone, you're a slave. You know, that was offensive at the time, although Kurt Flood eventually won his suit and is more famous. But these basketball players did this before Kurt Flood. But, you know, just briefly to go back to the AFL thing, so the NFL cuts a deal with Huey Long, says, if you bring me a franchise to Louisiana, the New Orleans Saints, I'll subvert the antitrust laws of the country and allow this merger. And effectively it does. And that's how the AFL and the NFL got together and eliminated the bargaining power for the players. So now the ABA comes along in 1967, and the NBA says they're going to do the same thing. Well, the NBA players, now led by Oscar Robertson, and I go back into that history too.
Yeah, right.
It's essentially a history of the NBA from 57 to 75. And to me, what's significant of that is not only the famous players, Wilt and Russell and Cousy, Oscar Robertson, Jerry West, mm-hmm, all these tremendous Hall of Famers, Elgin Baylor, but it's never discussed anymore. It's essentially, I always look at it, that the ESPN nature of sports. They started in 79, and they have no film before that. So there's nothing that existed.
That's so interesting. You're absolutely right. I mean, you think of these great players and what they did to really set the table for the players of today. It's astounding. Sam Smith in studio. The book is called Hard Labor, The Battle That Birthed the Billion-Dollar NBA. Let's take a break. We come back. Let's talk about the ABA and the NBA because, in effect, like the AFL and the NFL, it gave players at least a little bit of leeway to leave a team and go back. But again, it caused trouble in the sense that mergers and there was harbingers of things to come. Sam Smith, my guest at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download Here, 720 WGN. My guest tonight, Sam Smith, longtime basketball writer, one of my faves, author of The Jordan Rules, which is one of the best books ever written about Chicago sports. His new book is called Hard Labor, The Battle That Birthed the Billion-Dollar NBA. All of the players that we know today, whether it be Russell Westbrook or LeBron James or Steph Curry, and they really owe all of their financial success to players like Oscar Robertson and the players that essentially had to sue the NBA to start free agency. That at the core, it sounds simple. Right. But it's not, because at the time, this is a different league. Athletes are treated differently. We talked about ownership rights in perpetuity. They were fighting tooth and nail, the NBA, the ABA, everyone involved, to make sure that this kind of thing did not happen.
Well, absolutely. And the interesting thing is just because something has happened now, it doesn't mean it was inevitable. You know, so just because the NBA players have these abilities in free agency, it could have been like the NFL players, who really don't have the kind of free agency because they didn't have the union structure, and they weren't able to fight the league or didn't fight the league. And so these guaranteed contracts, that all these elements that have made the NBA players the most prosperous in all of sports, didn't necessarily have to occur. So what happened with this group of players, Oscar Robertson leading this union back in the mid-60s, when the NBA, and the ABA has a grand history. I mean, it basically was started by a bunch of businessmen trying to get into the NBA. And that's why they picked a lot of these southern markets in Memphis they were in.
They were looking to be merged,
right,
essentially.
They came
right
in wanting to be merged to enhance their value. And if you remember back then, a lot of people aren't old enough like me to remember that, but remembering back then, the NBA was a very conservative league. Even though you had the great Celtics fast breaks in the 60s, it sort of degenerated in the 70s to a slower game. And so the ABA comes along as this sort of outlaw league, yeah, but rival league. And really, if you look back to the great things about the NBA now, dunking and 3 points and everything now, that all element, it came out of the ABA because it was sort of an essence of, it was black basketball, it was street basketball, it was combining all these elements of style that the more corporate NBA was reluctant to embrace. And so the ABA sort of almost pushed that on it, but they were not funded like the NBA. So the NBA sort of eventually was able to wear them out. But these players came along because there was no free agency. In effect, there was this reserve clause, which was the history of baseball, which started in the late 19th century, where a certain number, I think it was five or six players, were allowed to be reserved for that team. That became known as the reserve clause, and the Supreme Court inappropriately accepted that in the early 20th century ruling. So now baseball, you know, didn't have the antitrust laws to deal with. So the other leagues did. And so the NBA players, led by Robertson and what I call these Robertson 14, it was essentially the player reps from all the teams, some big names, some not, Bill Bradley and Chet Walker with Chicago, and but lesser guys, Mel Counts and Tom Mascheri, Don Kojus, who was an original Bull in the 60s, was out in San Diego, I think, at that time. And so these guys all go to Congress to file
to say this is antitrust.
And the difference was and there's great stories in that, too. They get to the committee, and it's Sam Ervin, who goes on to much greater fame in the Watergate committee as you know, the key prosecutor. But he basically, rather than what happened with the NFL owners, the NBA owners come in and say, well, we want you to ignore the antitrust laws in effect. And he said, well, you know what? If we'll do that, if you're asking us to do that, I think what we should do is have the government run all sports. And that was, you know, your holy crap moment for sports all of a sudden. Like, whoa! No, we don't want that.
Right.
Well, he said, well, if you're asking us to overturn the antitrust laws of the country, we have to have a say in this. So now the NBA players, Oscar and these guys, are finally on strong ground. They go into court. They win in court. They're in Congress. And now the NBA is starting to drop these cases. So, you know, they're starting to win. But what happens when you win and you beat your boss, there's ramifications for that. You know, Oscar Robertson, who is one of the great minds in the history of the game, brilliant player. I mean, maybe coincidence or not, because he is, I know Oscar a long time, he is prickly to deal with. But, you know, for that guy never to get an offer to be a coach or general manager or a position with any
team. Even having a television job that at one point the NBA says,
right,
why is this guy on TV? He doesn't like the league. Essentially, the NBA went out of their way to make sure that Oscar Robertson didn't have any association with the league.
You know, you can't prove blackballing and all, but Chet Walker, his last season in Chicago was 75 when they almost went to they lost to Golden State, and Golden State went on to sweep Washington for the title. He averaged 19.6 that season and didn't get another offer the next season. He of course, that was the end of the suit at that time, and it was also pretty clear that, you know, they were into settlement. That was in 75. And so things, obviously not everybody. Bill Bradley was one of the plaintiffs, and he did fairly well after that. Became a U.S. senator.
Well, I'm interested because a lot of people who are NBA fans or sport fans, they'll say, well, you know what, these guys now, well, they knew what they were getting into, or I don't have too much sympathy for these players because they make millions and millions of dollars. But when you look specifically, and it's in this book, Hard Labor, when you look at what these players had to endure in a different time in the 60s, the racial inequality, financial inequality, the idea that they weren't even considered talent. At a certain point, I mean, they were considered cattle in the way that the owners were like, this person plays this position. There's some great stories in the book of people who came out of college in the first round and first pick overall that because of whatever situation, they didn't fit in with the team. And that was it. That was their career because they didn't have the ability anymore to jump around or hadn't even started yet. But my point being that to look back at the stories that preceded Oscar Robertson and the 14 going to Congress, going to the courts, you can understand why.
Well, what resonates a lot to me is that what these guys went through, they were essentially, I know people look at it like pro athletes and, you know, they're spoiled. And relatively, it was in that era. They averaged $20,000 salary, and the average American worker salary was like $4,000 or $5,000. So they were paid more. The gap, obviously, like in the rest of our society now, has expanded exponentially, you know, the 1% and all that. You know, they were sort of considered ultimate. But in a sense, they were freedom fighters of their era because, I mean, consider there's so many instances. Elgin Baylor sat out a regular season game. Consider these things going on in this era. We always say that. Well, could you imagine if this was this and Twitter with all this stuff? He sat out a regular season game because back then, to be fair, the NBA economics weren't great. It wasn't like, you know, New York or Boston even was selling out. They weren't. Hockey was more popular. And in fact, the NBA was born by the hockey owners just wanting to get additional dates for their arenas.
Right.
I mean, that's how the NBA came in. And I go back and take a lot of history of the league because I, you know, I really enjoyed the history of the league. But so they played at so-called neutral sites. Like the Bulls used to do, they would play in Evansville because Jerry Sloan was popular down there. They figured they'd sell a few extra seats. And so they were playing in a game in North Carolina, and Elgin couldn't eat in the restaurant or stay in the hotel with the other players. So he said, well, I can't do that. I'm not playing in the game, and didn't. It was a great Celtics story in the book I tell where they went back to Kentucky on a trip, you know, with Cliff Hagan. They were doing his jersey, and Adolf Rupp never allowed, you know, black players. So they went home. And there was one barnstorming thing. In the preseason, these guys used to play 20 games in 20 days straight. You know, you hear guys now moaning about back-to-backs and stuff. And so they went to Indiana, and somewhere in Indiana, southern Indiana, and they got a, you know, a little parade with the mayor when they came in, the NBA team, key to the city and all. And then they couldn't eat in the local restaurants. So they go to the mayor's house that night and brought them back the key to the city. And, you know, so these guys went through such racial humiliation in part of this, even though they were, you know, some of the greatest athletes in the history of the game.
And to think that we haven't even talked about some of the strange stories, and we'll do this after the news, but the strange stories of, I guess you call it recruiting, where kids think they're going to certain schools and they're kidnapped.
Yeah,
in a way to go.
Chet Walker,
yeah, I want to get to that. Sam Smith in studio with me. His new book, Hard Labor, The Battle That Birthed the Billion-Dollar NBA. It's out now. One of the great Chicago sports writers, also the author of The Jordan Rules. We'll take a break. We'll get the news. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation. Sam Smith at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download Here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Sam Smith in studio with me, the longtime Chicago sports writer, award winner, the author of one of the greatest Chicago sports books of all time, The Jordan Rules. He's got a new one. It's called Hard Labor, The Battle That Birthed the Billion-Dollar NBA. In it, he talks about Oscar Robertson and his suit to essentially start free agency for the NBA and to really question and challenge a merger between the NBA and the ABA back in the 60s, 1970. It is a fascinating look at not just the politics and what it takes, labor inequality, all the things that are even referenced with the title, but the history of what these players had to endure. Right before the break, we talked about, it's amazing, these kids at 18 years old, essentially picking a school to go to, and then getting kidnapped and brought to a different school.
Yeah.
And they had to go along with it.
We think if you heard that kind of story now, you would say, well, that can't be. And
there'd be authorities involved. Yeah, that can't be, right?
Chet Walker told me this story. Chet was from Michigan. His mother was picking cotton in Mississippi and Great Migration. In the 40s, they come up to Michigan, and he becomes a good player, and he's recruited to go to Nebraska, and that's where he's going to go. Actually, it was Fred Hoiberg's grandfather was the coach there at the time.
Oh, wow.
Fred later told me this story as well. It was in the book, too. And so Chet, a friend, offers to drive him to Nebraska. Now he ends up basically in Illinois at Bradley. And so, you know, and they say, well, this is where you're going to school. And he said, and they had a couple of these things, was he had an incident where he was betting pennies and they put him in jail or something for gambling. We know the racial treatment of blacks in this country has been, you know, a great sin. But, you know, as he said, look, you know, black kids were getting hung if you went to the wrong place. So it's the middle of the night, and he ends up being spirited off to Bradley, and they say, this is where you're
this
playing.
This is where you're going. You said, well, so I'm supposed to go to Nebraska. Playing here.
So he tells me this story, and I don't really half believe it. And I'm sort of questioning. I'm trying to figure out how I could figure. And then I hear almost an identical story from Joe Caldwell, who is another one of the plaintiffs in the suit, yeah. Ends up at Arizona State. He was supposed to be going to UCLA. A guy got him. He was, you know, the night, said, hey, you want to go to a party? And ends up at Arizona State and said, this is where you go in the school. And these kids, you know, this is a time where black kids are being hung for who knows, you know, any right. number of things. And so these incredible things are going on in the United States in the 1950s and 1960s. It's unbelievable.
And that's at the college level. Then you talk about the NBA level. You talked about the stories earlier about, you know, the stars, Lenny Wilkins. This idea that you could play and be a star for these teams, for an NBA, for a league, and yet they won't let you go into the restaurant.
Well, Lenny's is an amazing story.
Yeah, you know, that's amazing.
Hall of Famer as a coach and a player, and he's starting. He's an all-star for the St. Louis Hawks. And I remember there was two sort of border cities. You know, they're still fighting the Civil War in a lot of places, and St. Louis and Cincinnati were in the NBA then. And that's, you know, part of Oscar's issue. And, you know, playing his career in Cincinnati, basically eventually being run out. The team ended up moving. So Lenny is starting for the St. Louis Hawks and Bob Pettit, Cliff Hagan, you know, the last actually with
big
the,
stars,
only,
right?
the only team to break the Celtics winning streak there with Bill Russell because Russell got hurt that one year. But a great team and, you know, potential dynasty type team. And so he was a starter, and the restaurant across the street had the pictures on the you know, big glass pictures, big like the WGN studios here on Michigan Avenue. And, you know, of Hagan and Pettit and all the starters, including Lenny. But he couldn't eat in that restaurant because he's black. And these guys couldn't barely say anything. You know, Oscar Robertson's wife marched at Selma and had to escape, you know, in a pickup truck overnight, you know, being chased out of town and, you know, couldn't go. He when his daughter was born, he couldn't go be with his wife because that wasn't allowed. You know, you couldn't have a player couldn't leave a team. You know, he said, well, even Oscar Robertson. Oscar told me, and that was an amazing thing. You know, all these guys had to work the off season. He worked summers for Pepsi. Remember, you seen the Pepsi guys with the pinstripe Pepsi? You know, that was Oscar Robertson in the summer going around working for Pepsi.
With the time and the age of the civil rights movement and what was happening in the country in the late 60s, were the African-American basketball players, the NBA and the ABA, were they aware that this was unacceptable? I mean, is this really what started the idea of the suit and free agency and everything, that this is really about civil rights? The idea that you can't have this kind of league where these white owners essentially own these basketball players?
Well, they didn't look at it as strictly a civil right. They were part of a civil rights movement that nobody knew they were part of the civil rights movement, because the notion was, well, they're professional athletes, they're spoiled, look at all the money they make. You know, and just because Wilt and Russell are making $100,000, that was the big thing then. Wilt and Russell made $100,000. Well, the average salary was $20,000. And when the suit started, the average salary, I think, was $18,000. And when the suit ended, the average salary was $90,000. So they had, you know, because of the leverage they gained with the ABA, they were able to work themselves up. You know, they became, you know, civil rights pioneers, in effect. But they were pioneers for their sport.
Right.
They were sort of alongside the civil rights movement. You know, you can't quite compare them with what was going on, you know, in Detroit, you know, and Martin Luther King and everything, you know, the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. But the point is, for NBA players, they were those pioneers for this generation of NBA players. This generation of NBA players would not live as they did if not for the sacrifices these guys took while becoming great players and then going through these tremendous indignities all the time. You know, roommates, the conditions they travel in. Tommy Heinsohn told me this story. There was no team buses then. You'd get ridden to the arena. Literally now, when the hotel's across the street, they take a bus to the arena. It's across the street. Really?
That's now, right?
I've seen this all the time. The notion, well, they're rich and all.
They can't be on the street. They can't be on a sidewalk, Sam.
The guys would pile into a cab to get to the arena. So then they get reimbursed by the coach, you know, when they get to the arena. And have Heinsohn told me the story about, you know, they got four guys in. They got there, it was $350, and they went to Red and said, you know, it cost $350. Red said, I'm in the same hotel. It cost me $3.25. That's all you're getting.
And pick up the rest, right?
And that was it. There was nothing you could do about it. There was you know, there's no leverage to this. And so these guys, you know, on a lot of issues related to, you know, their careers, but more, you know, the freedom of any American worker to say, look, I don't like my situation. Can I do something else? And these guys didn't have that.
When you think of the NBA today, and you think of all the players and free agency, we just saw this past year, the major teams, they're building these super teams. People can go where they want to go. There's a lot happening. The players, it's definitely a players' league.
Which is good.
Do they look back to, when you talk to these players, and do they recognize the sacrifices that were made by their...
Not at all. Zero. Now, to their credit, and I give them credit, they did, in the last labor agreement, they included a provision for medical payments. But, you know, most of the guys who played in that era are on Medicare now, you know, so... You know, it helps with supplemental some. They're shocked. They have no idea. But it's like any kids growing up in this era. You know, like I said, and I go back to that ESPN example, just because of the way they came to dominate sports, and nobody talks about, you know, that era and those players. They've heard of them. Everybody's heard of their names, but they've never seen them because, there's essentially no film on it and no clips. And, you know, occasionally be a documentary.
Yeah.
But when I tell players about this, in fact, Chet Walker lives in L.A., and he told me that he ran into Jamal Crawford, who used to be with the Bulls, was playing with the Clippers last year. Chet has the second highest scoring game in the history of the Bulls franchise. Got a 56-point game. He was a great player with the Bulls. He's in the Hall of Fame. And so he met Jamal and he introduced himself. And he says, you know, I used to play for the Bulls. He said, really? I mean, Jamal, who's a bright guy, one of the more knowledgeable guys, had never heard of Chet Walker, you know, who was.
And he played on the same team in the same city, right?
Franchise. And, of course, Jamal says to him, Chet was telling me the story. He said, Jamal says to him, well, I thought I was the only other guy who got 50 points. You mean you got 50 points? He said, well, yeah, I got 56 one time. And so he scored one. And that's an example. But, you know, look, Americans are not good on history. And so the difference is with NBA players is they make a point to say that this is their history is part of a family. And that's always the thing because I hear it all the time from players when you're around media and around, and I'll say, well, you don't understand because, you know, we're part of this special fraternity. Mm-hmm. But they don't understand. And that's fine. You know, that's not unusual. But at the same time, you're in a position that you really can do something for the client. You know, most of these guys are dying, you know, and many of them who I've spent time with, and they don't like me to mention their names, and I'm not going to. But different guys who I visited when I was doing the book, and that was the great thing for me. I was able to, you know, spend a year or more going around seeing these guys and spending a day with them or whatever. And some of them are living in houses they've been living in for 40 or 50 years. And, you know, they're doing okay. Some, you know, but look, things have gotten so great. Can't you do something to say, you know, establish
some
fund,
money aside, put a fund
something.
Together. Right,
it wouldn't
right.
take much. I mean, in some cases, it's really awful. There are guys living in assisted living places that, you know, need. And I've heard. I know some of these guys who they are need. You know, just sundries, just to get through. And so,
toothpaste.
Right, and you know, there are groups. The NBA has funds to help. There's an ABA group out of Indianapolis that has funds to help. But there's just so much money now in the NBA. And so much spread around. And one guy I'd like to see do more, because he has tried, Chris Paul, who's now president of the Players Association, he has a recognition of history and appreciation. Doesn't know a lot of it. But when he hears about it, I can see that he's always sympathetic to it. And I'm kind of hoping that he will. And that's
attention to
that's
it.
Why I did this book, basically. Yeah. Read the book. There's appeals in there a couple of times to say, look, help him out. Do the right thing.
Do the right thing.
Do something.
Yeah, that's right.
Just help them out. Just do something.
When you think back to that, because we're coming up 50 years here. When you think back to that era, the era right before, and actually when you think about the years between 1970 and 1976 where this suit was happening and the NBA and the ABA were merging or about to merge, when you think about the owners of the NBA and people who are management, do they look back at that time as one of fond memories? Or do they look back and say it was a rocky, tumultuous time for the NBA? No, that was terrible for the history. Because you make the point that it could have gone one way or the other. There were some players that were like, I don't want to be involved with this suit. This is bad news for our league.
Well,
but it actually turned out to be huge for the league.
Well, it's scary because, you know, the threats were you're going to lose your job, you know, because you had nowhere to go. You know, there was one league, and if we're able to kill the other league and, you know, you saw what happened, like the football players who broke the strike line. You know, they wouldn't let them come back and play, you know, most of them, basically. So, you know, obviously, you know, Oscar and, you know, other these guys weren't going to be, you know, they weren't going to lose their jobs. But a lot of, you know, mid-level guys, like some of the guys on the suit, like a Mel Counts or a Tom Mascheri, you know, Jeff Mullins, whatever, you know, who knows? I mean, the league can go on fine. You know, the truth is, look, Michael Jordan retired. And the league is more profitable than ever was. So institutions always transcend individuals. So everybody sort of knew, you know, everybody understand that on some level. But at the same time, they said, look, we should stand up for not only stand up for each other. But the point was not a single one of them. And they all knew it at the time would not benefit from what they did. Yeah. That the free agency that they got in 1976 would not really begin to come into effect until the late 70s, early 80s. And all of them would be out of basketball in it. So they knew at the time that they were standing up for a personal risk that not a single one of them stood a chance of benefiting from. But they knew it was the right thing to do, and it was right for their game. And they said it would make the league stronger, and it did, and it always has.
It's an inspiring story. The book is called Hard Labor, The Battle That Birthed the Billion-Dollar NBA. The author is the author of one of the greatest Chicago sports books, Jordan Rules. Sam Smith, who covers the Bulls for Bulls.com, longtime Chicago Tribune columnist. Sam, great to see you, and thank you so much for being my guest at the Big Table, and thanks for writing the book.
It was great. Thanks a lot for having me.